Hello, welcome to the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined, as always, by Matt Oper. How's it going today, Matt?
It is going very well. Xavier's losing, so awesome.
I really can't ask for much more than that. And Cincinnati, 3-0 in the AAC. Let's jump into basketball. Looking back at the first couple of games of league play, looking towards the biggest home game of league play this Thursday against SMU. You know, the Bearcats coming off a win at Houston, a game which we deemed like their toughest road test. And it was a test they passed, all things considered, pretty easily. Like, Houston made it a little interesting late, but like, the Bearcats just went down and pulled out a pretty good win over a decent Houston team. That's, even with that loss, Houston still has the makings of a tournament team, I think.
Yeah, at this point, I would say Houston has an outside chance of being somewhere in that 10-11 range, one of the last at-larges into the tournament. You know, it seems like we do this every year where we get into the beginning of the season and predict, oh yeah, there's only going to be one AAC team in the tournament. And if it started today, there'd probably be three, maybe four. I mean, this has become quite a basketball league. You know, it is a power league in this sport for all intents and purposes, and that's with some pretty atrocious teams at the bottom of the schedule.
Yeah, the teams at top did a good job of not losing too much during the non-conference. Even though, as we said back in December, probably our last podcast, like, nobody had any great wins. But not having terrible losses does a lot. And the league isn't really that far behind the Pac-12 on the KenPom rankings. I mean, they still trail, but there's a big step between the AAC and the A-10. Like, it's solidly the seventh best league. And like, not all the Power Conference teams are going to finish with good records. So, they won't all make the tournament. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a ton of Power Conference teams. But, like, the AAC is going to slip in at least two, I think. Maybe even three, depending on what happens in Hartford. Or wherever the hell that tournament is.
It's in East Hartford again.
It's in Hartford forever.
People go there. I think that's why.
for some godforsaken reason.
Yeah. The shocking thing when looking at the KenPom numbers for the conference is that as a conference, there's only one league in the country that's worse than the AAC at scoring the basketball. They also play at the second slowest tempo out of any conference playing in Division I. I think those two factors are related.
Oh, and the fact that they shoot the worst out of any conference in the country?
Also related.
But they do block the most shots. So if you like to block shots and offensive rebounds,
this is the league for you.
While SMU is right now in first place, helped by Cincinnati's bye week, pretty much, the Bearcats are right in there. They favorites to take the league lead because they're pretty substantial computer favorites against SMU. Just what have been your thoughts on over the three wins against Temple, Tulane, and Houston, more recently Houston?
I mean, the biggest takeaway from this has been that Mick is leveraging the depth of his talent and the depth of this roster in new and kind of interesting ways. We've talked about how the need for UC to have more variability in their offensive attack and how they approach games generally. In previous years, UC really hasn't had the personnel where they can kind of flip styles at the drop of a hat. This team can kind of do it. You know, a guy like Trey Scott, who is, I think, really an incredibly advanced freshman, even redshirt freshman, in terms of his feel for the game, his ability to get in good spots time after time. And he is perfect if you're going to play a team going up and down, you know, playing a high possession game. But if you're going to play, if you're going to slow it down and try to control tempo like they did against Houston, he doesn't have as much value in that situation because he's not a great half-court offensive player. You know, he can scrap a few offensive rebounds here and there, but that's not really something that you're going to build your offense on. So he didn't play a lot in the Houston game. I think he only logged like nine minutes, maybe something like that. But I think he's going to have a big role to play against a team like SMU, who is they play even slower than UC does, which is saying something. Their tempo is truly, truly glacial. So he can have, the other part of that, the reason why SMU plays so slow is that they only have six guys. Like, six guys play. That's it. They have their five starters and one bench dude. So, like, you need to kind of punish them for their lack of depth. And UC is in a position where they should be able to do that. I wouldn't say with ease, but they should be able to control tempo that way.
Yeah, that's the biggest... I think that's the biggest advantage UC has against a lot of these teams. Is, like, if one guy's having an off night, somebody else can step up and put in points and carry you through the tough stretches. Like, this game, the Houston game we're talking about, that Copain, foul trouble, doesn't play, what, the last, like, 10, 12 minutes of the first half. Like, he still had a pretty decent game off the bench. He only played 25 minutes, that, and he had an injury in the second half. It's like you have Gary Clark get you through spurts. Jacob Evans hit a couple threes. Kyle Washington had a very nice game with 19-9. Like, you have enough depth 1 through 5, even 6 if you count Cumberland when he's got his game going. And that's like such a clear advantage, because look at Houston, when Rob Gray really struggled with his outside shot. He's 9-22 from the field. Did have 21 points, but... 21 points and 22 shots, you take that every single day of the week if you're Cincinnati. And Houston's really sunk when their stars taking so many shots and missing so many, and they don't really have any other scorers to fill that void.
Yeah, I mean, that's Houston's real problem, is that they only have Rob Gray, who can get a bucket whenever they need it. And that really showed up, because the Bearcats defense against Houston was outstanding from start to finish. I think they held them to their lowest efficiency mark of the season by a huge stretch. I mean, they were like 0.8 points per possession, which is just outstanding. The one thing that I'm cautiously optimistic about this team in terms of their ability to make a big run, because it seems like very quietly, Troy Copain might have found his shot. He's shooting 50% on threes in conference play. It's an extremely small sample size. It's not going to continue at 50% for the duration of the conference season. But if he can get back to hitting 40% of his threes, this offense becomes something unlike what we've seen from Mick's previous teams. They've really slumped in their KenPom efficiency numbers. I think they're down to 57th, which is the best of the Mick era, but just, and not nearly good enough to make a deep run in March. But if this mini trend becomes something that lasts over the rest of the season, I mean, that's a game changer for this offense.
Yeah, the offense, just to hit on that real quick, the efficiency in the three league games down to 103. And that's coming off you putting 92 points on poor Tulane. They were very inefficient against Temple. A game we probably shouldn't talk about too much since it happened last year. But
I see what you did there.
But the offensive depth is really, really a key. Because, like, the league plays slow. And so I think really having multiple guys does you a lot of good. And the three-point shooting is something that UC really hasn't shown off a ton like the past few years. And even this year, they haven't shot the three great, but in conference play, the guys have been knocking them down 42%. So I think that's a pretty encouraging sign, especially some of the looks they got against Houston, where you have Gary Clark hitting from the corner. You have Jacob Evans, I believe, a couple of his threes were from the corner. Even Kevin Johnson was getting some good looks. And then you have, of course, Kyle Washington. Probably shouldn't be as confident with his three-point shot as he is, but the one he did make was pretty crucial. The one he missed was a nightmare three that, if Houston made that basket on the other end, it was a completely different game.
Yeah, absolutely. And you really hit on the key point with the three-point shooting of this team right now. It's not the result, it's the process. They are getting extremely good looks from three in the last few games, and that goes back to the Marshall game. Marshall's an atrocious defensive team, so that shouldn't be that surprising. But that they've been able to kind of generate these clean looks from deep for their best three-point shooters, that is such an encouraging sign, because for most of the season, it seems like the only thing the offense can do is slowly wait for one of the posts to duck in and get good post position and go from there. That added wrinkle, that ability to shoot from deep with accuracy, it really complicates how teams are going to try to defend the Bearcats. And the key for this going forward is Kyle Washington. He did something in the Houston game which I have not yet seen in his career as a Bearcat. He passed out of a double team to a wide open three-point shooter who made it. He got an assist. He's still prone to throwing up the most awkward, ugly-looking hook shots. Like, he reminds me a bit of Tyler Hansbrough and his ability to just throw up absolute garbage that goes in with such a high frequency that it beggars belief. He's still going to go up, but if he can pass out of that double team four or five times to get the ball swinging, that's all money for the Bearcats offense.
Yeah, averaging over an assist a game in conference play for Kyle Washington, which sounds like not great, except he had...
sound great, but he was averaging like a pass a game.
He technically didn't have an assist in this Bucks score I'm looking at, but he had four against Tulane. And before that, you have to go all the way back to Texas Southern when he was credited with an assist, which was on December 13th. He had, in these KenPom box score, he had two assists in the month of December.
Is that bad? Is that bad?
It's not ideal.
I wonder what his ratio of assists to potential assists, like plays where an assist was there and he just, fuck it, it's going up.
Very, very, very high. I think we joke, but him cutting the turnovers, which he's done in conference play, albeit small samples, he's cut the turnovers, picked up the assist to at least an acceptable level, and bam, the offense looks a little more fluid in some of these half court situations. Obviously, that they're not great. And the Temple game or the Houston game, nothing outstanding, especially against Temple, who really gave them fits. The turnovers, I don't know what's happening, but the defense has been out of this world. Of course, you look at the two of the three offenses they played. Temple's offense is garbage. Tulane is playing high school kids, but the Bearcats on KenPom, second best defense in the entire country.
We know that number is inflated because, as we discussed at the top of this, there is not enough good shooting or good offense in this conference to punish UC for the way they play defense. Good offenses with good shooting, they can really exploit mixed preferred, hybrid, man, zone, whatever the hell you want to call it, with passing, with spacing, with good ball movement. It's easy to be done. We've seen it. Butler did it. Marshall did it. It's not that difficult, but you have to have those two things. You have to have a bevy of good passers, and you have to have shooting.
Which
just looking at the numbers, you're not going to see much of those two things in conference play.
Except with the team they play on Thursday, the SMU Mustangs, who have by far the best offense efficiency in the league right now. Their four league games, it's 120.4. Houston is second at 103.4. So the gulf between them is gigantic.
Go ahead. To be fair, the Houston number was much higher before the game. I think they were somewhere around 116, 117, which is still outstanding. But the Bearcats have a deflationary effect on offensive numbers for everybody. So Houston's very, very good. You know, Houston's not very, very good, but they're good on offense, especially if Rob Gray's healthy. SMU's good on offense. But we'll see what that number is coming out of the game, because I'll bet it takes a fairly significant step back.
SMU, like, their biggest strength has been their three-point shooting. Like, nearly 44%. And they're an SMU team. And like Cincinnati, that means they kill the offensive glass. SMU is rebounding nearly 50% of their misses. Like, you look at their schedule, and they're like, there is, like, a cause for, like, oh, they played East Carolina, Temple, South Florida. As well as Memphis, which was a tough game. They just absolutely steamrolled their last three games. They won 10 in a row. The nice win over TCU, that's a pretty decent win at Memphis. Like, especially since Memphis doesn't seem like they're like that bad. So it's going to be a pretty tough game, especially since we know what Cincinnati and SMU do when they play.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about SMU and how they play is, and Mick scoffed at this in his press conference previewing this game earlier this week, SMU plays six dudes. They are all between 6'5 and 6'8. Most of them are 6'6. They don't really have traditional positions. They're the type of team that is going to befuddle this defense because of their ability to rotate positions and move in and out of the post with relative ease. Not everybody's going to be effective down there, but the way they move the ball and move men is going to be something that is very difficult for UC to face, because like this offense is basically full of switch killers. Like they can force you to switch and switch and switch until they get an advantageous matchup, and they will do that. It's going to be a fascinating thing to watch in this game, because it's basically the offensive version of how UC plays defense, where it's not really conclusive and you're not really sure what you're watching, but it's effective.
Yeah, SMU is going to work to get switches, get their guys on poor defenders. It's kind of like an NBA offense. And to their guys' credit, like, Owale, he's killing 44% from three. Sterling Brown's 47% from three. Shake Milton's 38% from three. Jerry Foster's 44%. Those guys, if you give them looks, they're going to knock them down. And to, like, we've mentioned their offensive rebounding before. Like, they hit the glass hard, which does leave them open for transition. So we've seen UC exploit in the past couple of meetings, especially in Cincinnati, where it seems like the Bearcats have been able to run on them a little bit. Of course, it's a different SMU team with more pure athletes than the past teams. Like Marcus Kennedy, nice player. Nobody would say he's like a tremendous athlete.
Nick Moore, tremendous player, not an athlete at all.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely not. Like a great college point guard. Like, not a world beater. Like, you wouldn't put him up against anybody who actually made the NBA, since he's probably playing in Europe or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, this team is really, it's a fascinating team to watch, SMU is, because of, like, they, last year they played at one of the fastest tempos in the conference because they had more depth, they had Nick Moore, who was better at a faster pace than he was in half court. And then, you know, all these guys go and they completely reinvent themselves in this sort of brand new scheme that perfectly suits their lack of depth. It accentuates the ability of the players that they have on the roster to do so. And you're absolutely right in comparing it to an NBA team in terms of how they hunt mismatches. Like, you know, I'm a Cavs fan. There is nothing in life that gives me as much joy as seeing LeBron and Kyrie do a pick and roll, because that's all they're doing. They're just hunting a mismatch. LeBron's going to get a point guard on him, and he just backs it down. SMU isn't that simple, but they hunt mismatches. They're so methodical in their ability to do that that they end up finding whatever guy you have on the floor who's going to be a mismatch, they're going to find him. And we all know who that guy is going to be. His name's Kyle Washington. I mean, the big question for this game is, Kyle Washington brings a ton to the team offensively in this matchup because he is far bigger than anybody else that they're going to be able to throw on him in the post. He will be able to get whatever he wants one-on-one, backing people down. At the same time, they are going to put him in the action every single time down the floor until he makes a mistake and cracks. They're ruthless about that.
And we've seen it, like, where he's kind of been, like, run out of some of these games. Like, Temple, he didn't play a ton. Butler being the prime example, where Butler switched him off the floor in the first half. I think that's going to be a huge key for the Bearcats, because can they get enough out of Washington offensively where he can put up with maybe some defensive lapses? Or are you going to try to play a lot of some of the bench guys, like Trey Scott and like Brooks? Like, Trey Scott played a ton against Butler. Like, will he play a ton against SMU? Like, maybe. But, like, can you take a 4-on-5 offensive hit like that? And that's a pretty big question mark.
Yeah, and the other guy to watch in terms of bench contributions and what we're going to get is Cumberland. Because he is brimming with confidence. Like, earlier in the season, it was clear that the game is way too fast for him. He wasn't up to speed. He looked lost. He looked out of place, especially on defense. And on offense as well. But in the last three games, he's been able to torch second units pretty much by his lonesome. I mean, occasionally he's running with Copain, but for the most part, it's him and Justin Jennifer. And he does a lot of the ball handling in those matchups, which is an interesting wrinkle to have because, I mean, for so long, UC has only had one ball handler. I mean, even when UC had two point guards in Gidd and Copain, they only had one ball handler. That's not the case with this team. Like, Jacob Evans can handle the ball. Copain can. Jennifer can. Cumberland can. Like, there are options for that in terms of just relieving pressure. And in a game like this, that's a vital thing to have. The bigger point here, even if it's not Cumberland, they need to dominate the bench. Like, their bench needs to dominate because SMU doesn't have one. Not in a real sense. So they have to win when they get opportunities to go against their second stringers, however limited those opportunities may be.
Yeah, their bench is what has, like, been I can't pronounce his name. I can't remember how to say it. Malugu. I don't know. Pretend that was right. He terrorized UC last year, if I'm remembering correctly. It's that guy. Number 21. Like, one of their guys who always comes off the bench. The Sterling Moore role, where he comes off the bench and just like, oh, that guy, why is that guy scoring 12 points? Like, go away, random guy. It's what it seems like SMU always does to Cincinnati.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that one guy. But, like, I mean, if you're a good coaching staff and you're playing UC, you're going to have to coach up your secondary guys because they are so well scouted on what you do that a lot of the things that you relied on to generate buckets, to generate points, they're really not going to be there in this game. So you need to have backup plans.
Just looking through the box score last year, the game in Cincinnati, SMU was only 2-12 from 3. Nick Moritz shot 8 of them, and he made them both. Like, so, it's like a pretty much a completely different SMU offense that you're going to see. Because the thing the Bearcats did last year, even the game in Dallas, SMU 5 of 15 from 3. Like, Cincinnati just completely takes away that shot from SMU. And they really make SMU work on offense. Even when the Bearcats have lost, which it seems like they've lost in Dallas, like, every time, and they win in Cincinnati every time. Like, most of the games have been pretty close. And, like, the big difference is SMU doesn't force turnovers. Just, like, that's just not the way that they play defense. And Cincinnati's been able to really work them in the games that they've won. In the games that Cincinnati's given away, it's because the Bearcats haven't made shots. So it's going to come down to how good of looks can you get and how many good looks can you take away from the Mustangs. It's like, it's a, only a six-man team, but that's a pretty confident six-man team rolling into Cincinnati this week.
Oh, it's a really good six-man team. But, like, there are obvious weaknesses to SMU right now. And I think the biggest one is, who's the point guard? Like, who is it? Is it Milton? Is it Brown? I mean, they don't really have one. So what I would look for UC to do is not so much press to generate turnovers and just cause chaos, but press to make them exert energy. And that's, like, you were talking about how SMU plays, how they don't really generate steals or turnovers, or they don't really kind of look for that. They just play solid. Like they're the NFL. They're the college basketball equivalent of a team who plays really solid cover two zone in the NFL. It's like, we're not going to give you anything easy. We're going to make you work for everything you get, but we're not going to make unnecessary gambles. And they do that for a couple of reasons. It suits the personnel. It requires less energy. Like, playing the way that UC does with their constant harping on deflections and creating turnovers and general havoc, that takes a lot out of your guys. And UC can play that way because they have a lot of guys. SMU doesn't. So they don't play that way. But if UC can get them into that situation, that gives them a huge advantage because it's not something that they're accustomed to. They haven't played a defense with this kind of tenacity, length, and just all-around suffocating, you know, ability at any point this year. So this is going to be a different animal for them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a really interesting ball game on Thursday night. How are you leaning? Do you think the Bearcats keep the streak going against SMU? Or is this the time that they get tripped up by SMU and Cincinnati?
I think they're going to keep the streak going. Just having it at home makes it, it just gives me so much more confidence because this is a completely different team at home versus on the road. And the way that the building feeds off the energy of this team and the way they play, I mean, it's clear the guys like Cumberland and Justin Jennifer and Trey Scott play much better at home than they do on the road. So take advantage of that and get your contributions from those guys in this environment, and they should be able to take care of business.
Yeah, I'm on the same page you are. It's like, they should be able to take care of this one. Like, my only real worries would be keeping SMU off the foul line, which isn't really a problem for UC teams in general. But SMU's been living at the line in conference play. Cincinnati never gets to the line. SMU has the lowest free throw rate defensively in the league, so it's not really something I'm worried about. But keeping them off the glass, like getting into the, like, SMU's legs, like that, so that lasts like 5-6 minutes. Like, you want to make that so your guys are peaking and their guys are on dead legs, and you can win the last 5 minutes. Kind of like the West Virginia strategy, how, like, they press to get your legs gone when it matters the most. And with how hard Cincinnati plays defense, if they can make SMU work for 25 seconds every possession, I think that they should be able to pull a solid, like, 5 to 7 point win down.
Yeah, and the other key for this game is going to be simply ending possessions, rebounding. SMU is an extremely long team, and it shows in the rebounding numbers, especially their offensive rebounding numbers. Like, they are one of the best offensive rebounding teams you'll see. Like, that is a huge key. And the offensive glass has been a weakness of the UC defense all season long. They're currently ranked, what is it? Basically around 200, call it 200, in the country in allowing offensive rebounds. That's a suicide mission against SMU because of the way they attack it. But if they can clear possessions and, more importantly, run out of those possessions, like, that is something that will clearly favor UC, because the faster tempo this game is, the better off they are.
Cincinnati playing the second fastest tempo in the league right now. Under 70 possessions a game, but that's the second fastest.
That's terrible.
Tulsa played 60 possessions a game. How is that even possible with a 30-second shot clock?
Can we go to a 24-second shot? Can we just call it what it is? Like, 24 seconds? It just is what it is.
Speaking of rules we should change, they need to get rid of the charge. I've seen this, like, talked about on NBA Twitter, but it's more obscene in college. They're not going to get rid of the charge. They need to get rid of the secondary defender sliding in. Because you can't drive in college basketball without the secondary guy sliding in and picking up a charge. It's ruining the game, I think. Because it's not just one possession. It's any possession. Like, a point guard beats his guy off the dribble. It happened against Houston. Cumberland beats his guy off the dribble. The guy from the left box comes forward and picks up a charge. Like, that was garbage. Like, they needed to just scrap the charge completely and just make it an offensive foul. Like, still would be an offensive foul. But if it happens against a secondary defender, it's a foul of that guy 100% of the time. That would make the game a lot more watchable.
Yeah, I mean, like, that is the worst rule in college basketball. I mean, I can't think of anything that it... I mean, it would help a lot if coaches had fewer timeouts. Oh, I mean, there are enough stops in the games for commercials that you don't need timeouts at this point. Like, legitimately. One or two. And would it be that bad if players just had to play through shit?
Where do you stand on quarters? Where are you on that debate? Do you think they should go to quarters, or do you think halves are fine?
Halves are fine, but you have to... Like, halves are fine, but you can't have teams milking clock the way that a lot of teams do currently. And it's not just... Like, there are some exceptionally good offensive teams who play at glacially slow paces. SMU is one of them. Virginia has been that team for 5-10 years. Under Bo Ryan, Wisconsin was that team for 20. But most of the teams who play at that pace, they do because they suck. And by playing that slowly, they're not giving themselves more of a chance to win. They're decreasing their chances of scoring. And without scoring, you don't win. Like, you're going to get better outcomes from having bad offenses have, you know, 80 possessions a game versus having 60. You're just going to get more cracks at the bucket. It doesn't, like, if everything else stays the same, shooting stays the same, skill level stays the same, but you have more possessions, you're going to have a better game, period.
Just looking through the tempo stats on KenPom, the 25 slowest teams in the country. Like, Villanova is way down there. Like, their offense, number one, still. Like, nobody would be like, oh, look at Villanova. They run such a fun game. It's like, nobody talks about how dynamic they are. Everybody talks about, like, UCLA and, like, Kentucky and Carolina. They can do, because, like, teams that normally play fast. Like, Virginia, obviously the slowest. They have a good offense. Like, St. Mary's, number 11. Does anybody really talk about how awesome St. Mary's offense is? It's like
No, but that's because everybody's asleep in St. Mary's Place. It's not their fault.
Fair point. Like Michigan top 20 offense, but just because Beilein's a genius. And then like you like really don't have that many more near the bottom. Like Wisconsin, Baylor, both on the bottom 11. So then you get like your Milwaukee's and Texas State's and Oregon State's and St. Peter's. A bunch of garbage teams who are just garbage, and it doesn't matter how slow they play because they're terrible. I think the trend of like more of the quality teams, especially like Villanova's and Butler or Baylor's, teams that normally played fast starting to play really slow. I don't know. It's kind of worrisome. At least I think it is. Like you don't want the game to slow down. You want the game to speed up.
No, and that's why, like, I love college basketball. I've watched college basketball my entire life. But as a product, I like the NBA better because it's just better. Like, they made rule changes 15 years ago that are still being, that we're still feeling the reverberations of now. And, you know, pace and space. There's more shooting than ever. Three-point shot attempts are higher than ever. Three-point shooting percentages higher than ever. And that's league-wide. That's not just because Golden State and Houston and Cleveland are just bombing away with tremendous effectiveness. It's that everybody's shooting more threes and everybody's shooting threes better. Like college basketball is in serious need of a similar, like, holistic rethink of how they structure their game, because it's just like if you turn on a random Sun Belt game in Wednesday, you know, on Wednesday in January, are you likely to find a entertaining basketball game? Like, are you likely to be enthralled by what you're seeing? Probably not. If you have an attachment to the one of the programs involved, you're going to watch because it's your team. But that doesn't mean that the product's good.
It's kind of interesting because college basketball seems to be slowing down. And college football's going faster than ever.
And college football is more popular than ever. Like, it just, like, I don't give a shit about the ratings being down. Like, whatever. A handful of percentage. Ratings are going down because fewer and fewer people have cable television. That's why. It has nothing to do with the quality of product on display and all that. Like, it's just, college football is our best sport because it's the most entertaining sport, and it has the most variability. And why is there variability? Because in 1980, everyone decided that Jimmy Johnson's 4-3 defense killed the option, and we got to do something else. And it took a long time, you know, to get from that point to this point. But they, like, you will turn on a college football game on Wednesday versus Northern Illinois and Toledo. Chances are, you're going to have a good time. It might last 4.5 hours, but you're going to enjoy yourself for 4.5 hours. I mean, it's really hard to find a basketball game, a college basketball game that only lasts 2 hours that you enjoy start to finish. Do they happen? Of course. That's not happening every week. That's not happening every day. And that's kind of a long-term problem for the sport.
And really, it happens less than conference play. So, like, the further you go in the season, the pace slows down. Shooting, I think, normally goes down. And like, because the teams are more familiar with each other, you get almost a completely different game. But let's put a pin in that conversation for another day. But continue to talk about football, because since the last time we spoke, Luke Fickell put together a coaching staff at Cincinnati. Right now, officially on the Go Bearcats page, Marcus Freeman is the defensive coordinator, linebackers coach. Doug Phillips is your special teams coordinator. And there's a bunch of other people that don't really have big roles. But we know Mike Denbrook is going to be the offensive coordinator, even though it's not on Go Bearcats. It's been reported for a long time now. Joker Phillips also on the staff as, I believe, a receivers coach. Ron Crook, former West Virginia offensive line coach, was taking that position at UC. John Tanua is apparently joining Cincinnati's staff, longtime defensive coordinator, including formerly at Virginia, and Al Washington, defensive line coach. He was the Boston College defensive line coach and their special teams coordinator. So what do you think about Fickell's staff moves? Are you excited, depressed, neutral?
When Luke Fickell was first hired, we said a lot of this would come down to in terms of how to evaluate his tenure here at UC would come down to who he could get for his staff. We're seeing who he's getting for his staff. He's knocking it out of the park. Like all these guys were, with the exception of Al Washington, I believe, who Steve Adazio really, really wanted to retain in his role there. They were guys who were kind of being pushed out. I mean, Joker Phillips was an offensive quality control analyst with Ohio State last year, so it's not like he was. Consider that a rehab stint in terms of going from being a former head coach in the SEC to that. That seems like a demotion. But getting him back at UC where he has previous experience, I mean, I think that's a hell of a coup. He's a great recruiter. He knocked out of the park as a recruiter with Florida. Obviously, with Kentucky, he did a good job with that as well. I mean, these are guys who are well-known in their profession. Like, he's not plucking guys out of obscurity. Like, a lot of these guys have extremely high name recognition, especially in football circles. And that's huge for a program like UC, where typically the assistant coaches you have are fresh-faced, young, hungry, underpaid, but aggressive as hell. UC hasn't had a staff like this in quite some time. Like, you have to go back to the first minute teams that got to bowl games where you had, I mean, if you go back and look at some of the coaching staffs that Rick Minner had here, like, my God, there was one staff that had three NFL head coaches on it. Okay, two now, but still.
Yeah, Rex Ryan is the defensive coordinator, famously. Like, Mike Tomlin, wasn't he on the staff?
Okay. Yeah, Tomlin was on the staff, as was John Harbaugh.
Pretty good coaching staff. If only one of those guys could have succeeded or Rick Minter.
Yeah. They got back to a bowl game for the first time in 40 years. I think they did their job.
Fair point.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it's just so much of success in college football comes down to your ability to organize, maintain, and eventually retain. So, like, they got this good staff together. That's job one. Job two is keeping these guys together.
Yes, that's going to be the big thing, because we've seen it throughout the entire league. If you have any good coordinator, position coach, anything, you're going to get poached. You're going to get poached bad. You're going to get your staff potentially cleared out by the Power Conference teams. So you just can't match money with some of these teams, or even match like position upgrades for some of the other guys. What are your thoughts on Denbrook specifically? He's like the Notre Dame associate head coach, called their plays until Brian Kelly took that over. Then became like unsure if he actually called the plays or if it was Brian Kelly doing it last season. But as someone who has not been overly impressed by Notre Dame's offense lately, like, that one really didn't move the needle too much for me, but so I'm willing to give him a chance. He can't be worse than Zach Taylor.
I mean, like, Denbrock is a guy who, he's one of the guys we talked about who was kind of pushed out at Notre Dame. That's, like, I don't really put too much stock in that at this point. If this goes pear-shaped, I might look back at this podcast and say, oh yeah, I should have thought something of that, but I didn't. But, I mean, all that being considered, anytime you're on Brian Kelly's staff, Brian Kelly is the offensive coordinator. He calls the plays. I don't care what your title is, he calls the plays. That's been the case his entire career. So they say they stripped Denbrock of play calling abilities. That's more of a, I'm going to throw this guy under the bus because I need to placate some rogue faction of the boosters who are deeply unhappy with where we're going. And it wasn't just the offense that was a problem for Notre Dame this year. It was everything. Like, everything went pear-shaped for them. They lost to frickin' Michigan State, who had one of their worst years since, like, pre-Saban era. And like, John L. never had a year that bad.
And it did start with them not making a decision at quarterback, which, of course, is not Denbrock's fault. But, I don't know, the fact that they really couldn't pick which quarterback should have clearly started last season when there was a clear guy that should have started last season does make me wonder if they're going to have some weird competition with Hayden Moore and Ross Trail and quarterback X that they bring in this year. I don't want to go through another year of who the hell is going to be the quarterback all summer, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, at this point, I will be shocked if Hayden Moore is a starter or plays a significant role in anything other than a Ross Trail injury. Like, for everything that Luke Fickell has said in terms of what he wants his offense to be, the philosophy he wants them to have, what he wants his quarterbacks to do, there's only one guy on the roster who does that, and it's Ross Trail. Like, that's the beginning and end of it. Like, they're not going to tell him that he's going to have to earn the job, et cetera, et cetera. But there's only, like, there's one option. And that's not even taking into account the fact that we know exactly what Hayden Moore is. Good backup, not that good. You don't want to rely on him to go out and win games on his own, because he can't. He doesn't have that ability. Especially if he doesn't have Chris Moore and Mikhail McKay and Shaq Washington to throw to. I mean, like, Hayden Moore's limitations are vast, and we know exactly what they are. I just don't think there's any way that he can start in this offense because his skill set doesn't match what they're looking for. I mean, like, obviously, it's early. We don't know what the offense is really going to look like on the field until August. But I'm reticent to throw Denbrock under the bus simply because he had a testing experience in one of the most politicized coaching environments imaginable. Like, I don't really hold that against him.
That's fair. And he's been coaching there for a long time now, and obviously they've had success when he's been there as well. He didn't do every single thing terribly his whole coaching career, or he wouldn't have been a coach for like 75 years.
Yeah, I mean, and like, they were bad this year on offense. They were bad this year everywhere. It wasn't just the offense. The defense was terrible, too. The special teams were an atrocity. Like, Notre Dame just had a bad year.
And two years ago, they were, what, like a game at Clemson and a game against Stanford away from making the playoff.
Yeah. And he did that with a redshirt freshman quarterback who had not really seen any real action. And, you know, what he did with Kizer that year, like, he's a quarterbacks coach and offensive coordinator. And he was a passing game coordinator before that. Like, I don't have many doubts about his ability to call a competent offense. Like, the problems at Notre Dame last year were deeper than him.
Yes.
That being said, he's going from, and this is the other thing with all these guys, is they're going from a position of, almost all of them, of relative abundance in terms of resources. They're going to be, you know, resources at their disposal, talent on hand, et cetera, et cetera. UC is talented for the AAC. And they are not talented by the standards of Ohio State, you know, Notre Dame, even Boston College. Like, this is a different thing. So how do you, like, they're being asked to do something they haven't been asked to do for a very long time. That's the interesting thing that I'm watching over the last couple of years, is because, like, you're not going to hit on everybody. You don't have five-star talent everywhere. You need to maximize the talent on hand. And that's a new exercise for a lot of these guys. So, you know, how do they adjust? What's their approach to that going to be? It's tough to tell now, but that's one of the things I'm very, very interested about and very curious about, because, you know, relative scarcity coming from complete abundance it changes your environment and your ability to operate substantially. And that adjustment alone is enough to throw some people off their jobs entirely, you know? It's just going to be an interesting factor to watch with them.
That's a really interesting point that I hadn't really thought about too much. Like, just reading off the list of where all these guys came from, like, all power schools. Like, Denbrook's been recruiting for Notre Dame for the last decade, pretty much. That's a pretty big change going from somewhere, especially given how the landscape has shifted dramatically since the playoff era has begun, where there's a clear line between the Group of Five and the Power Five schools, which we can't ignore because it's like flashing neon every single day. And the gap keeps getting wider, it seems. But some of this recruiting, it's going to be really tough. Like, what do they do when they can't get the guy that they want? Which you can't imagine has been too much of a problem for some of these guys when you're recruiting to, like, a Notre Dame or Ohio State or, like, even a Boston College where you can, like, wrangle in a lot of the Northeast guys, because where else are they going to go? Like, UConn? No, nobody goes to UConn.
Yeah, which is why they're on. I mean, does he count as a new head coach?
Technically, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, but that. What's going to be interesting. Okay, so looking back at the Tuberville era, there was, in terms of the recruiting ability, there was no consistency because there was no consistency with the staff. There was so much turnover, especially on the defensive side, that it made recruiting locally exceptionally different. And that's a completely different conversation from the one we've been having for years about how people in Cincinnati don't perceive Cincinnati as an institution the way that people outside of this area do. You know, I have brought it up before how for kids from Columbus and Toledo and Akron and Cleveland, Cincinnati is the school right now. It's a very hot name. A lot of kids want to go there, and that has a lot to do with the money that's been poured into the campus. I mean, like, really, it is one of the most breathtaking and beautiful campuses on earth. There's really nothing like it, and the first time you see it, it really does take your breath away. And, like, that's a huge asset in attracting, you know, high caliber students and attracting people from different areas. Like, that's a huge calling card. A lot of people locally, they don't perceive that because to them, Cincinnati is still the commuter school from 30 years ago. It's not, but their perceptions haven't updated to reflect the new reality. And that makes recruiting difficult locally because you already have the stigma attached with the UC name. Everybody tells you if you go down there, you're going to get robbed and shot every day. And that's like a huge factor if you're going to try to recruit with Kentucky and Louisville and shit, Indiana, Purdue, Illinois. Like, those are peer programs in terms of performance on the field for the last couple of years. But to a lot of local people, that's like they're on a different level than UC. So, like, all that was baked into the cake before Tuberville even got there. Add into that the fact that he didn't hire anyone who was local. He didn't hire anyone who knew anybody in that area. So he had a brand-new coaching staff, almost all of whom who had spent their entire careers in the South. And it was incredibly tough sledding to recruit Cincinnati kids, given all of these factors that they inherited and the ones they created for themselves. So, and then you add in the turnover, especially on the defensive staff. Like, guys would walk into schools with the C-paw on their chest, and they would try to recruit these kids, and you know how Cincinnati is. It's incredibly insular. It's like, why would I listen to you? I don't know you. You're not from here. Like, everybody's heard the joke about how the first time you meet from Cincinnati, they'll ask you what school you went to. And they're not talking about college. They're asking what high school you went to. And your answer to that question will determine your social status within the group that you're in. Like, that shit is so Cincinnati, it's ridiculous. And it's tough to overcome if you're not from here, or if you spent time here. Which brings me back to the new staff. All of these guys are people who have recruited the Cincinnati area extensively for the schools that they've been hired for. Denbrock spent a lot of time in Cincinnati. He recruited Kyle Rudolph, just to give one example. Al Washington spent a lot of time in Cincinnati. You know, Keekly was one of the guys that he was involved with when he first got to Boston College. Like, and you go on and on and on with these guys. Like, these guys are known quantities in Cincinnati. That's different. In the past, UC had one guy to do that. I mean, that was Kerry Combs' job while he was here. It sure as shit wasn't to coach the secondary well.
And already we've seen, like, this pay off with Jarrell White committing to Cincinnati. Like, a composite three-star on 24/7 right now. Just pretty nice. And you get one of the bigger name guys in town from a pretty strong school like LaSalle. And like, the one thing, if everybody wonders, like, with like some of the local guys who commit, like, where were his offers from? He had, like, Big Ten offers. Like, Boston College was in on him. Illinois, Iowa, Iowa State, Kentucky, Pitt, Purdue, Toledo, Western, Kentucky. Like, a lot, like, as you just mentioned, all the big power schools around here that have been coming to Cincinnati and trying to take talent. Or not trying, they've been taking talent. And, like, one of the local guys turned them down for Cincinnati for once. And it's, like, such a big boon to Cincinnati recruiting. Like, finally locking up a big-name player in town.
Yeah, and, like, this causes reverberations because Jarrell White is... He might not be the highest-rated prospect in the area based on star rating and projections for his future output as a recruit. But he's one of the biggest names in Cincinnati. Like, he was a two-time All-Ohio player at LaSalle, the strongest program going now. I think that's beyond dispute at this point. They won three state titles in a row. They're just rolling. And UC got him. And he's going to sign. Like, that's a huge sign. And, like, in the wake of his commitment, you see a lot of, you know, stuff on social media from guys in next year's class who are highly regarded players who are like, okay, you know, you see hired Al Washington. You see hired, you know, Marcus Freeman. Like, these guys are known, especially the recruits. And they're like, okay, so now this is an option. And Tuberville offered White. He didn't recruit him. Like, they spent zero time on him. And the minute that Fickell got the job, he was priority number one for the staff. And they just showered him with attention. And that did a lot to kind of change his mind about what the Bearcats are and what the Bearcats could be. And that's the first, you know, like, that's the kind of recruit who can change the perception of a program within the small insular community of Southwestern Ohio football. And UC is not going to win for the four-star guys often. They're not going to win for the five-star guys. But they don't really have to be an effective team and to make regular runs at conference titles and, you know, New Year's Six Bowls. Like, there are, I think, 34 players in the 2018 class who are consensus three stars according to 24/7. 14 of them live in Cincinnati or Dayton. Are you going to get all 14? No. Can you get six? If you get six, you have a start to a phenomenal class by AAC standards.
Yeah, absolutely. If you get six, that's like a foundation for the future. Like, you're starting in a good place if you lock down, like, 6 3-star recruits. Especially
yeah,
with
and 6 3-star local kids.
Especially with how most of the league has been trending downward in recruiting lately. It'd be a gigantic boon. Because, like, you have to keep up with Houston. Like, we'll see if their recruiting keeps up to where Tom Herman had it. And we'll see what South Florida does. Like, they've been knocking it out of the park lately. And Charlie Strong, one thing he's always been able to do is recruit. Even if he hasn't been able to, like, win at Texas. Texas has a ton of good players. And look at every preseason top 25 that came out last night. They're in pretty much all of them in the top 20, it seems. It's like, you have to keep up with the Joneses, and I think this is a very good start. Like, that's one of the things, like, we were, like, optimistic about Fickell, is that he'd be able to recruit Cincinnati, something that nobody else has been able to do lately. And, like, it's a really nice start, getting a big-name guy to stick in town. And, like, it only, like, as you said, it only takes one to start the trend. Like, getting Gino Gadulli was a gigantic get for Rick Mitter's staff. Then they were able to keep some other local guys in town because they landed a guy everybody had heard of at Highlands for years and years and years.
Yeah, and the guy, like, Jarrell White's a huge first step, but the guy that could really do that, like, who could really do damage that way, is in next year's class. And he's a legacy kid. It's Archerell Hawkins' son, Aeneas Hawkins. Plays for Moeller. UC does not do well in GCL, or hasn't done so for a very long time. But the one school they have done well in is Moeller. And he's, you know, he's predicted to be an Ohio State recruit. He's crystal balled there on 24/7, according to everybody. But he has been very frank about taking UC very, very seriously as an option for him. And if they could get a guy like that, like he has to be priority one for the staff, because he's a legacy, Archerell Hawkins' son. Everybody knows him. He's been around, like, a very polished football player. Like, that's the kind of guy who can change the fortunes, not necessarily of a program. Like, he's not a five-star guy who's going to do it. Like, you know, he's not Ed Oliver. But the perception locally is that that's one of the best players in the city. And historically, guys like that just haven't gone to UC. Especially guys with that kind of talent who go to GCL schools, they don't sniff UC. They don't come close.
And as you mentioned, like, having a legacy guy, star at UC, star for the Bengals, star in air quotes for the Bengals, the high draft pick for the Bengals. Like, keeping him, like, in a UC uniform, it would just be gigantic. And, like, obviously you're up against a huge challenger with Ohio State. But, like, if you can just get in the conversations, which, like, UC hasn't been in lately, like, that's another big step. Like, something the Tuberville staff tried to do, and it didn't really work. But if you can be in, like, the local names, like, people know UC's a force in town, not just, like, oh, a fallback option if you can't get an offer from, like, Indiana or Illinois or Purdue. Like, yeah, that's a pretty big step up.
Yeah, I mean, historically, the higher-ranked kids from those kind of schools, they go to the Big Ten school. And if it doesn't work out, they can always transfer back to UC. That's been the mentality. They've never been able to get those guys to consider UC seriously coming out of high school. You know, one of the most interesting things that Tuberville did, like, he got a recruiting visit out of a top 10 consensus player. Like, a five-star, all-world, all-everything dude. He got CeCe Jefferson to come to campus. Now, CeCe never really took the Bearcats seriously. It was more about Mike Boone and getting to spend time with his best friend. But it says a lot about the perception of things that they, in that period between that visit and Tuberville's firing, there have been something like 12 four-star or higher players from Cincinnati. None of them visited UC officially. You got to change that perception. And it starts with one, and it builds from there. But, like, I'm as optimistic about Luke Fickell and this staff being able to do that as I am about, you know, anything that this group is going to do. Like, that's the thing that I'm most excited about with them.
Yeah, and the number one thing you need for as a program after last season is our optimism and buzz. Like, last season ended with a gigantic thud of no one giving a shit. And, like, turning that around to get people interested in UC, like, interested in how this season's gonna go. That's step number one. You have to start small and get people reinvested in the program. And then you win games, so you can go from there. And for however long as Luke Fickell stays in Cincinnati, like, hopefully, it's like, it's kind of weird, because, like, you hope he does great. But if he does great, he's going to be out of here quick, because he's going to be a name in demand, you would assume. Because he's still relatively young, and obviously a great recruiter. But then, like, at the same time, if he does okay for, like, 3 years, it'll just turn into, like, Willie Taggart. So I guess there's really, like, no great way for his tenure to end, but you just hope in between the beginning and the end there's a ton of wins and a conference championship and hopefully, like, a New Year's Six Bowl mixed in.
Yeah, and that's where, like, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen fast. Like, that's the one, like, that is the most interesting thing about college football in recent years, is that previously in the 70s and 80s, coaches got a chance to fail a little bit before they succeeded. You know, you think of a guy like Sean Beckler at Miami. Like, everybody remembers 83 when they won it. Everybody forgets that he took the job in, like, 1977. And it took 6 years to build that. Now, you win in 2 years or you don't win. And that, you know, Urban Meyer took 2 years to have a great season at Utah and bounced. He won a national championship at Florida in his second year. You know, Nick Saban won a national championship in Alabama in his third. Like, if you're going to win big, you win big quickly. I mean, that's going to be the test for Fickell, because if he doesn't get that done, his star will fade to some extent. That doesn't mean he can't be an effective coach and lead UC for a decade, and they have a lot of relative success compared to the conference mates. But this is a hyper-competitive environment, because the one thing this conference is doing better than anybody else is they're hiring. Like, they're hiring really well. To the point where you have to wonder about sustainability.
Definitely. Like, because, like, you can only hit so many home run hires in a row before somebody comes up short.
And then, well, before math hits you in the face.
There's no good coaches left.
Like, not every hire works out. Like, and it has nothing to do with the ability. Like, Charlie Strong is a perfect example of that. It didn't work out at Texas. That's not because Charlie Strong can't coach. Like, he might have deficiencies tactically, but above all else, he was a victim of a, how do I phrase this? An aggressively politically charged situation.
Yeah, to say the least. Or his biggest, or the guy who hired him, like, what, didn't, like, even, like, last the first year he was there?
Nope, he was out. Quick.
Yeah, like, what you mentioned is, like, pretty interesting about, like, the timetable. It's like, Willie Taggart was only in South Florida for 4 years. Yet it seems longer because his first 2 years, they struggled. He, like, tore it down and built it back up to, like, a 10-win program. Like, yeah, I don't know. It seemed like he was there for, like, 7 years. I don't know why. I guess because his first 2 years lasted so long, it seems.
Well, Bill Conley has a concept that he calls year zero. It's when a coach takes over a situation that appears to be on the surface to be kind of benignly positive, if anything. And it turns out to be just a complete dumpster fire, and you have to build everything from scratch. USF was like that. For Charlie Strong, Louisville was like that after Craig Thorpe. Colorado, good God, was at a year zero situation. They had like 3 year zeros. And now Mike McIntyre won 10 games and was coach of the year and is riding high again.
Getting paid a lot of money.
Yeah, it's just, we don't know how deeply the rot set in with the Tuberville era. Like, there was a story in, I think it was the Thamel piece on Fickell, about how nakedly visible in the corner of Tommy Tuberville's office was a graphic from the Butch Jones era about foundational goals or whatever, some bullshit like that. Like, it says a lot about where things were that they never even bothered to change that. It's like, this is a graphic from the previous coach who left in ignominy and is reviled by large segments of your fan base. But you have his core principles still on your wall, visible to everyone.
No, they were good principles, I guess.
Look, I can't think of anything that really describes the apathy of the Tuberville era more than that. You can't even be bothered to change the fucking graphic. That's not hard. It's like, you go to the ops guy, it's like, hey, can you, like, you can spray paint it, but, like, I don't want that. But Tubbs walked in and was like, that's good enough.
Who put that there? That's a pretty good slogan. Let's keep that up forever.
Yeah. I don't know Fickell that well. I mean, obviously we'll get to know him a little bit more as this process evolves. But from my first impressions, my guess is he saw that and was like, let's do something else. Like, he seemed like the kind of guy who would see that and make note of it and change it instantly. And that's the kind of, like, those type of people, they are the type of people who win big early. And for all the shit Tuberville did in terms of, you know, completely checking out after, like, four games this year and ruining an otherwise promising season, I like a lot of the talent on this team. I like the receivers. I like Mike Boone at running back. I like Ross Trail. I love the defense. Like, I think there are pieces in place that they can win big this coming year. Whether or not they do, it really comes down to how organized and how prepared Fickell is for this opportunity. You know, neither of us think he's going to be here long term in 4 or 5 years. And I think in his heart of hearts, he doesn't really want to be here in 4 or 5 years. But to get to that place, you have to be ready and you have to perform now. Like, that starts now.
It's like the only scenario he's here in 4 to 5 years is in year 2 or year 3, they go undefeated. And then year 3, they go undefeated again and make the national title tournament. Look, that's the only way, right?
I mean, like, if he gets undefeated, goes to the New Year's Six Bowl and no good jobs in the Midwest Open, I can see that. But there's always a good job. Like, there are 10 to 15 jobs that you leave your wife for, if needs be, in college football. Almost every year, one of those pops open. Now, it's presuming a lot to say that Fickell's going to be the number one candidate for any of those jobs in the hypothetical future that we're laying out. But yeah, like, you just expect them to move on.
We'll just play this cursory game looking at the schedule. Do a quick predictive win-loss record for the season. We know the season starts against Austin Peay, so that we'll just count that as a win. They go to Michigan week 2.
Loss.
They go to Miami University week 3.
Ooh, at is tricky. Miami is feisty, man. And Martin wants this game badly. I like, on talent, UC's on a different level just altogether. But that's tricky. I want to say win, but we'll call it a toss-up.
Yeah. For the sake of argument, we'll count it as a win. We'll just count it as a loss. Who cares?
All right, 1-2.
Miami made a bowl game, and they could have won. They should have won their bowl game. They blew it.
They should have beat Mississippi State, yeah.
The only guaranteed schedule date, they play Marshall week 5 of the season. I don't know much about Marshall, but I don't think they were very good last year.
They were not.
Yeah, so we'll count that as a win. So we have them right now at 2-2 with their non-conference. They host Central Florida.
I'm going to say loss because I think Central Florida is going to be the biggest challenger for USF.
Yeah, it's 2-3. UConn, they win. Play, yeah, 3-3. SMU,
win.
4-3. I agree with you on that. If they went to Dallas, maybe something interesting. But
if SMU like had defensive players.
That game is one where it really depends on when that game is. Like, I'd much rather UC play them very early in the season than play them late in the year when they pick off some of the lesser conference teams and maybe get some confidence and momentum for themselves. Kind of like the Tulsa thing. Like, you just like knew looking at the schedule last year. At least when Chris and I talked about it, we both thought they would lose at Tulsa. Like back in August, just because like, oh, they'll be good, and that's the end of the season where weird shit happens. So that's just
yeah. I don't think any of us predicted what actually happened.
That game was the closest game of like the last half of the season too, and the fourth home game is Temple.
I want to say win.
3-1 in the conference home slate. So we have them, 5-3, right? Yes.
Yes.
The road games, East Carolina.
Win.
6-3, Navy.
Loss.
South Florida.
Loss.
And Tulane.
Win.
7-5, just going quickly off the schedule, not knowing any dates for conference games. I don't think that's too bad a first year run.
No, and like the only ones where they're going to be decided underdogs are going to be USF and Michigan.
Yeah, potentially Navy if Navy's feisty.
I mean, Navy's always feisty, but they're never like overwhelming in the truest sense of the word.
That's a fair point. Another game where it really depends where they play Navy.
Yeah, you don't want Navy in November. Navy in September. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the layout of their conference schedule is going to be pretty interesting because what do they think of Cincinnati? What do they think of Temple? Like, where do South Florida's, like, you know South Florida's going to end with all the good teams on their schedule. Like, where do they, where does the Houston game come from, USF?
Like, they're all going to be in November. They'll play Houston in November. They'll play Central Florida in November.
Yeah,
like, that has, you know what that has a feel of to me? An early September date with UC.
I could see that. Maybe the week before the Marshall game. Probably not. That's a road game.
Week 3.
If you go at Michigan, at Miami, outside of Florida, that's a tough slate.
That's brutal.
So hopefully that's when they throw in like the SMU game. Give them a little break. Or maybe Tulane. I actually know
I was gonna say East Carolina, if you need a breather.
That's a lane game kind of terrifies me. I don't know.
Well, that's right. It's in NOLA, right?
It's like one of those places with like no atmosphere, because it's a weird stadium, and Tulane like plays runs the option. Like they were kind of feisty last season. Let's talk about South Florida quickly before we end this podcast. Bulls preseason top 20 team pretty much everywhere. Dennis Dodd has them in the top 10, which seems crazy. But like, just like their non-conference is garbage. They'll be 4-0 in their non-conference slate. They host Cincinnati, Houston, Temple, Tulsa. Four good teams on their schedule. Their road games are Central Florida, UConn, East Carolina, Tulane. There's a pretty good chance that they could run the slate. So it makes sense that they'd be the overwhelming favorites, especially with Flowers coming back.
Yeah, and the one to circle there is at Central Florida. That's the only conference game I can see them tripping up.
It's definitely going to be the last game of the season.
Yeah, it's a rivalry game. It's what, the war on I-4, something like that.
So that brings us to kind of a secondary point that I want to mention. It's like there's been a lot of talk lately because the Northern Illinois, the AD, I guess, it's like shot off his mouth about a Group of Five playoff, which seems like a really terrible idea, especially since like the only like major game for any of the Group of Five teams is that New Year's Six Bowl. It's like the rest of them are all early December games that are kind of jumbled in together, one after another. The chances against Power Conference teams are terrible. I believe the first Power Conference team that played a bowl game was Mississippi State against Miami Oxford, which is not great when Miami University is getting the big crack at an SEC team. But, like, no Group of Five team has been ranked higher than 13th in the polls, which, like, really makes you think they're never going to get in the playoff. But, like, even then, with all that said, like, a Group of Five playoff is, like, one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. And really stupid. What do you think?
What do I think? It's the dumbest thing I've heard in a while in college football, and there are a lot of dumb ideas in college football, especially this time of year when football is not happening. So people have a lot of time to sit in bars and bullshit. Godfrey and Podcast Ain't Played Nobody, they talked about this. Godfrey's exact quote was, Mike Oresco says no, so it's no. And that's the end of the discussion. Like, it's not happening without the AAC. The AAC is just not doing it. The AAC at this point is, as a cohesive league, is so far and away better than the rest of the Group of Five schools that they are basically in their own category. Like, they are the middle class of college football, and it's just the AAC.
One of the things that they did mention, which is kind of where I got the motivation to talk about this, but even more, is if they do expand the playoff and the Group of Five is just left out of it without an automatic bid to the eight playoff spots. Which in that case, if that actually happened, they expand to eight and they lock out the Group of Five completely, like, you're never playing for the national title, and at that point it doesn't even matter what you do. So your bowl games are only going to get worse and worse. At least your marquee bowl game. Go ahead.
When they expand eight, the Group of Five will have a representative in the playoff. But until they expand eight, I don't think a Group of Five, like, Houston would be a very interesting case if they actually would have run the table this year, because you can make a very strong argument that they played a tougher schedule than Washington did, and they did more with it. Like, that could have been an argument, but they shot the bed down the stretch and they lost several games they shouldn't have, and they completely no-showed for the bowl game. But as a hypothetical, like if a team was going to make it, Houston could have if they ran the table. But it has to be a situation like that where you have multiple Power 5 teams on your schedule by hook or by crook, and you pull shit out of your ass.
Houston, like, fell right into the perfect schedule when they had Oklahoma already set. Then when Louisville did left the AAC, they had to schedule somebody, and they picked Houston. Perfect for Houston. They caught Louisville right on the rise of Houston football. Tom Herman's 2 years. Like, beat them twice. Like, beat them on national TV. Like, if you said, if they actually made it through undefeated, I think they would have made the playoff. Because their schedule would have been filled with, at least Navy was a top 25 team. They would have played South Florida in the bowl game, or not the bowl game, but the title game, and then South Florida would have ended still ranked. They would have had four, like, top 25 teams on their slate, which I think would have done it. But
yeah, that would have been enough to get them in there for sure. I mean, that's more top 25 wins than Washington did.
But that just shows how hard it's going to be for a group of five teams to
Oh, no, you're like, your margin is razor thin. Like it is infinitesimal, the margin of error you have.
I just remember doing, like, research on BYU last summer. Like, Bronco Mendenhall said, like, they'd have to go undefeated twice in a row to make the playoff. Because the first year, you're not going to get high enough. And the second year, you'd have the buzz off the first year. And then he went to Virginia. So, I guess that's how much he believed that BYU would make it. But, like, it's going to take something like, Houston got the huge push, and, like, with Tom Herman. And
they got the huge push with Tom Herman being the hottest name in the coaching profession, but they also had a catapult of a win over Florida State. And, like, whether or not Florida State no-showed for the Bulls, it's irrelevant, really, it is. They got beat, and they got beat decisively by Houston in one of the six games that everybody watches. And that was the platform for the season that Houston just had. And it's not that you have to go undefeated. You just need to do something to resonate on a broader scale so that you have momentum going into the next year. Like, you don't have to be undefeated, but you have to have a signature win, a signature event, moment, whatever you want to call it, towards the end of the year before your big push to do it.
And like, that's something that sounds like reasonable when we talk about it like this. The part that makes it almost unreasonable is any coach who does that is gonna be rumored to leave, and it becomes a big distraction, like it was for Houston. I don't care what they say when they write the book on this Houston program in 10 years. Like, I bet players will say this year was a major distraction with them not knowing what was happening. And they had a ton of pressure on them after they beat Oklahoma, which was clear when you watched them play some of the conference games. But, it's like, if you lose your coach, like, you're almost hitting the reset button. Like, if South Florida hypothetically goes undefeated this season, then going into next season, you would hear Charlie Strong's name brought up, even if he didn't want to leave. Like, the rumors are enough to crack somebody.
No, but it's different with Charlie Strong because he has already, he's already been through the cycle. He went from Louisville to Texas, and it didn't work out at Texas. Like, at this point, what does he have left to prove? Like, does he want to, let's say that McElwain gets fired at Gainesville because everybody hates how he plays and his teams are boring. Would he want to go back into that environment as a head coach and a highly politicized, a lot of people involved with the Florida program really love Charlie Strong. But there's also, it's hard to ignore the fact that he should have gotten the chance that he got long before he did. And a lot of that resistance, not that it came from Florida people, but it came from that time. I don't think the fans would have an issue with it, but they're for the decision makers in power, the money people have a lot of problems with Charlie Strong and what he represents. you know, kind of off the field. It's would he go back there? Possibly, but it seems like my guess is that he had his chance, he took it, it didn't work out, and I think he's at peace with it. Like, he seems perfectly content to be at South Florida. And everybody in the media kept talking about how this is the happiest they had seen Charlie Strong. Because everybody was in Tampa this week. Like, so many people got... Like, we're going to be inundated with Charlie Strong puff pieces and think pieces in the coming 2 to 3 months. Because the game was in Tampa and everybody was like, oh, yeah, Charlie's there. Let's go take a look.
Oh, and that did happen if you listen to some of these podcasts. Like, where a bunch of the media people, like, all met with Charlie Strong about one of the days on the weekend.
Man, it's like, y'all don't ever waste a day, do you?
I think that's it's kind of an interesting one. Because even though, like, with a case like his, like, as you mentioned, like, he wouldn't really have a reason to leave South Florida. But if, like, somebody big comes calling, like, I don't know. It's, like, it's kind of hard to turn some of this stuff down.
Yeah, like, but he's in his 50s now.
Very true.
Like, he's not the hot, young, up-and-coming thing. Like, you know, the hot, young... Like, one of the things that always bother me about the coaching carousel is talking about 40-year-olds like they're children. It's like, oh, this is a hot, young assistant. He's 44. What are you talking about, young? I mean, chronologically, I guess he's young for the earth, but, like... Whew. Yeah, but like that phrasing bothers me. Sorry.
I think it's pretty interesting already seeing Chad Morris's name thrown out there, and like they haven't even gone through year three yet.
Speaking of year zeros, I mean, if they win 8 games this year, he's out. Okay, he wins 8 games this year, and Kevin Sumlin fucks up again.
If he won 8 games at SMU this season, they should throw him a parade.
And build him a statue.
That'd be kind of remarkable. I kind of want them to win 8 games now.
They would be extremely interesting if SMU won 8 games. Extremely unlikely, but possible.
Like, for kicks, I looked up their conference schedule. Like, they're non-conference. They're going to lose to TCU. And they play Stephen F. Austin.
I don't know, man. TCU is garbage this year.
They go to TCU, though. That'll be... Stephen F. Austin, North Texas, Arkansas State.
So they have... they're probably, what, at North Texas? So they have two...
At home.
That's a home game.
Yeah. So 3 games at home, 1 game on the road. No weird road games this year for once. Then home slate, Central Florida, UConn, Tulane, Tulsa.
Like, oh, that sets up lovely.
Here's where it doesn't set up lovely.
Yeah, I know where it sets up badly.
Road games, Cincinnati, Houston, Memphis, Navy. Like, oh my god.
Good luck. So to win 8 games, he has to be 2 of Navy, Tulsa, Houston, TCU, right? Is my math right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. It's not likely.
So maybe hold off on the parade. That has to be hosting Houston Baptist in 2018. Maybe that'd be his incentive to stick around SMU. That big Houston Baptist rivalry out of the way. Anyway, I think we've hit the point where we're just starting to ramble about random things now. And
you know what I like is that we aim for an hour every podcast, and we just blast right past that shit.
Then we hit the 90-minute mark, which is
a surprise to no one.
If you don't listen to the podcast, like, fast forward, like, 1.5, I kind of feel bad.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is an official, like, we shouldn't be doing this, but we both officially endorse you listening 1.5. It's for the best. It really is. Like, we should not be taking this much of your time. We apologize. Thanks for listening, but we're sorry.